again, keeping in mind the merit of our learning should be for the injured from the attacks in Hanof. We are in Perek Bet, chapter 2, in Yov, in Job, and he has been struck a second time. He's now, well, we'll see, but he's going to be sitting on the ground, suffering from shchin, boils, disfiguring boils, in fact, as we'll see. And his wife speaks to him. We finally meet his wife, and we will say goodbye to his wife in the course of three sentences. That's her entire place in this book, and that's important for reasons that we'll see. So take a look, please, at verses 8 to 10. Psukim Chet to Yud. If you're using the stone Tanakh, you're on page 1622, 1623. He took a piece of pottery to scratch himself with, scratching these boils. And he's sitting in the ashes. And his wife says to him, do you still hold on to being a tum? Do you still hold on to being complete with God? Right? She used the same word that God used to describe him, and the same word that the Satan used to describe him. Right? Did the Satan actually say the word tum? There's only God who used the word tum. I think God is the only one who used it. Okay. So, Orcha machzik besumasecha, you still hold yourself as being tum. Borech Elokim vamus. Bless God and die. Well, the question is going to be, how do you translate the word barech? So that's part of what we need to understand. Vayomer Eleha, and he said to her in response, Kedaber achas hanivalos tedaberi. You speak like one of the disgusting people. Naval nevela is a word that we use for something that is repellent. What do you have in your translations?
Impious.
Impious. Interesting. That is not nevela. Okay. Vile. Yeah, there we go.
That's because it's one of the foolish women.
Foolish. I don't know why Naval. Oh, actually, no. Amar Naval, believe. No, but that's usually vile also. I don't know where they get foolish from for this. Shameless. Interesting.
Shameless woman.
Well, the woman is just because he says Nevalot in the feminine form. It's not inherent to the word. I mean, recall the person in Tanakh who's actually identified as Naval. Right? Naval, the husband of Abigail, right? And Abigail says to David HaMelech, by way of apology for her husband's behavior, she says, Kishmo Kein Hu, he is like his name. There's nothing inherently female about the word. But foolish, I'm not clear on why they use foolish as the translation. I'm surprised. Usually it's understood that it's something that is repellent. Vile is a good one. So, why do you speak like someone who is Naval? Gam es hatov nekabel me'esa Elokim ve'esara lo nekabel. We should accept the good from God and not accept the bad. That's his response. B'chol zos, and with all of this, lo chata Iyov bisfasav, Iyov did not sin with his words. Oh my, is this full of things you could talk about. Questions here, yeah. Questions, what do you have?
What motivates her to say that?
Yeah. I'm kind of surprised. This doesn't seem like the spouse I would have pictured for him.
Why would she... We were...
Well, who says it isn't? Who says it isn't blasphemy? Maybe it is blasphemy. Who said people die for blasphemy? Sorry, say that again? She sounds like the Satan. Very important point. We're going to have to come back to that. Why? There's so much here that's bizarre. Could the Eov, the Job we've been reading about from the start of the book, have a happy marriage with someone who takes this approach to life? Like, why does this make any sense?
But there's no question that you're assuming she's always spoken like this. Remember, she's also experienced the experience of children.
Fair. Fair. Whatever he's lost, she's lost.
So it is an unusual bet. One would not expect anyone to say, there's so many other things to say in that.
Yeah, I mean, seriously? Like, condolence card or something. You know, get well soon.
Shut it off.
I mean, yes.
Why does she want him to die?
Like, yeah.
I think she want her husband to be around.
What was she going to get him
through?
Right. I mean, unless she's not meaning it literally.
I think maybe she's suffering along with him.
So it's an expression of her suffering. So she can't take the suffering. Interesting. She speaks in anger. Okay, Susan, you were going to say?
From what I've read, first of all, they say it was leprosy. And that she just wanted him to stop the suffering that he was going through. It's better to be dead.
Right. I mean, right. The use of the term leprosy is a common mistranslation. You see it in a lot of these books that are written in late 19th, early 20th century English, because they take what is a known disease with a known set of symptoms and match it up to what's called tzarat in the Torah. And there is a mark of tzarat that is called shechin, and say, so tzarat is leprosy. The problems with that identification are multiple. Number one, just the fact that the Torah very clearly identifies tzarat as some kind of a spiritual thing, as evidenced by the fact that the Kohen goes to the person and identifies it as being tzarat or not, and there are offerings and rituals associated with it. Number two, the symptoms defined in the Torah for tzarat don't actually match the symptoms of leprosy. Limbs don't fall off with tzarat, you know, for example, whereas leprosy actually can proceed to that point. It's actually been suggested that tzarat is more closely associated with vitiligo. Vitiligo, which, you know, I find personally offensive since I have vitiligo, so that's my white eyebrow over here. It's a discoloration of the skin, not terribly dramatic in people who have light skin, but life-altering and potentially really life-altering for people who have darker skin, think Middle East, a very big deal. Yeah, they say that Michael Jackson had it. So that's why I would avoid the leprosy translation for it. Shin, more popularly in the Torah, like in the plague in Egypt, is boils. So that's why I keep saying boils. Yeah.
It's curious that we know nothing about her. We know something about Job. We're told something about Job. And she just comes on the scene and blows it all away.
Not just that. Look at her language to him. It sounds like she's saying that you're suffering and I'm not. Right? You're still going to be righteous. You should do... Like, what about her grief? Why isn't it there? Rita?
Well, I'm assuming Job, the man he is, his mate should be a woman who has empathy. Maybe she doesn't say it, but, you know, when a loved one is in that condition, then the person who loves them is in pain too, so she's in pain too.
But is this an appropriate expression of that pain?
No, but they might even say, you know, maybe you would be better off dead for you and me, because it's very painful for them. It's very realistic in a way.
I acknowledge that in a modern age in which, you know, euthanasia is on the table, you know, there might be ways that people would have this conversation. But in Tanakh, to say to somebody, better off dead is not...
I don't think she's suggesting that. I think that's an expression of her pain.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Like, she's, you know, she is in pain watching him suffer. Like, that's what I...
Okay, Susan and then Rebecca.
I mean, people were matched. Or sometimes, when they're three, they're matched in marriage at this time. Like, we're all assuming that they met the way you're talking and fell in love. But that's very unlikely what happened. They were probably put together either by deals with the parents as was the
time. Okay, entirely possible.
The fact that she's not a very nice person may have nothing to do with his choice of who he married.
Okay, now that's an interesting point. That's an interesting point. Rebecca, what are you saying?
Are you assuming that she is not in pain because she says, why you're still holding on to your tzimut, which doesn't mean that she isn't feeling pain. She's just questioning where he's gone with his.
Right.
That's one thought. And then, of course, the other is we have a theatrical presentation here, and she's playing a role, and that.
Right, so hold that thought, because I think that's probably very much what's going on, but there are a bunch of hands here. B.
What makes her think that if he is Mevarech Elohim, then he will die?
Yeah, this is an interesting assumption, right? Job, just blaspheme and you'll be dead, right? Like, why?
Bless, we don't know Mevarech means yet.
Or bless, even better. Like, why would that lead to him dying? It doesn't. Either one doesn't seem to have the sort of logical progression I would have expected. Shana?
In a way, not quite all the way, but this, it seems to me maybe this is like you're in the deepest of mourning and Pollyanna is next to him saying, oh, it'll be fine. So maybe that's why she's responding to him in such an angry way, because his simple-minded adherence to God is aggravating her grief.
Mm-hmm. Could be. In other words, they are really both sitting in the ashes together. Granted, the text didn't say so. And she turns to him and say, boy, am I sick of you. Right? That's an interesting idea. Yes?
I think it's like the perfect tipping point. If you really want to add insult to injury, then just keep it all. So physically, and have his wife, like, it's the perfect point. Next layer.
Right. So I'm going to come back to that idea as well. Okay. At some point, I'm going to have to stop taking this, but you've been waiting a long time.
Yeah. I almost feel like she's blaming him. She thinks, oh, he's always maintaining that he's such a great tzaddik and all this, and that now it's, she's saying, look, you're not so good after all, maybe you deserve this. So she's really being mean to him,
Oh, there's definitely, it certainly, to my ear, has a harshness. Although, again, if she's grieving, you have to just, take that with the grief.
Yeah, well, she's lost her children.
Yeah. Yes.
Perhaps in a similar vein to Eve with Nachash, the Satan has gotten.
What does that mean? Whether the Satan has gotten to her, how? If so, we're missing part of the story.
Right.
When does she become an agent? There's also other stuff going on here, by the way. We're like all piling it on in terms of Eve's wife, but. There are other elements here that are interesting. For example, in Pasuk Yud in sentence 10, it said, "B'chal zos lo chata Iyov bisfasav." With all this, Job did not sin with his lips.
What about his mind?
Well, what I want to show you is go back to the last verse in chapter 1, where it said, "B'chal zos lo chata Iyov." With all this, Job did not sin. It didn't say anything about his lips there. It sounds like now he didn't sin with his lips, but something else may well be going on. It's an interesting possibility. Another question. Now that Job offers this response, can we say that Satan has lost? Meaning, the first time round, we thought Satan lost and the game was over. So did God, apparently. And Satan said, no. There's another round, because you haven't done everything that you need to do in order to put him in that position. So now God has gone and done it. Okay? He's heard him personally. We've reached the point which the Satan said is the point at which he has nothing left to ask God for. He has nothing left to expect, and therefore he has no reason to serve you, and then he will denounce you, God. Right? That was what Satan had said. It's all been stripped from him. So, logically, what should happen now is he should turn on God, and he hasn't done it, at least verbally. So can we say the Satan has lost? Is the game over? So I think it's also a part of what you have to consider here.
Well, maybe that's why the suit follows that.
Yeah, I'm meaning.
That he didn't sin with his lips, but we don't know what's in his heart or in his head.
Maybe. And that's what we have to see a little bit of. But take a look at what I brought you on your sheets in source number 1 from Amos Chacham in his introduction to Da'at Mikra on Iyov. Describing Iyov's wife. Mikol ha'nefashot ha'medabrot b'sefer zeh. He says, of all the people who speak in this book, and the whole book is dialogue, right? So of all the voices we are going to hear, he medaberet ha'ma'at mikol. She speaks least of all. Rakshesh Milim. Velo Yoter. Six words, we've already read them. And that's it. She's not coming back in the book. She wasn't mentioned before. She isn't going to be mentioned afterwards. This is the sum of her role. So he suggests something which has been suggested here as well. Nimtzasha Satan Hishtamesh Be'eshet Iyov Shalomi Data. Satan uses the wife of Job, but I want to explain what that means. That has to be unpacked. He uses the wife of Job without her knowledge as a tool with which to seduce Job to sin. The words of Job's wife are a continuation of his tests. And let me now explain what that means here for us. We have not seen her before. The whole calamity before this, she was absent. She only exists within this book. Whether I take the book as an account of events, or whether I take it as a story made up to convey a message, however I do that, she is here in this book as a caricature. You know, you ever have a situation in which you're reading a book, and suddenly one of the characters does something that just doesn't fit what the character has done all book long, and you realize that it's because the author needed a certain event to happen, and so what they did was they just used the character to move things forward. Or, you know, a dramatic series on television, same idea. They'll have a character do something that's completely out of character because they needed the next step. Job's wife exists in order to do something to Job. Somebody needed, or I should say differently, the book needed somebody to push him further. And that's what she's here for. Don't look at this as, you know, don't try to read her as a bona fide human being with a backstory and emotions and A leading to B leading to C. She's so clearly here in the book just to represent somebody close to Job who is going to goad him. And that's why it's his wife and not just somebody out there making this statement to Job. I brought you a verse later on. I should have moved it earlier. I'll have to take care of that. It's source number 6. I referred you to Devarim, Deuteronomy chapter 13, sentence 7. Please take a look at it in your Tanakh. It's a verse dealing with incitement to idolatry. It is found on page 460, 461 in the Art Scroll Tanakh. Okay, then we see it. Ki yisidcha achicha venimecha, o bincha o bitcha, o eshet chekecha, o reacha asher kenafshecha. When, thank you, your brother, son of your mother, or your son or your daughter, or your wife, or your friend who is like your own life, tries to speak to you in secret, saying, let us go worship other gods, and so on. Do you see the flow? Do you see the way it builds? The commentators note that this is meant to be a progression. Your brother, son of your mother. Okay, so it's your brother who's close to you, your maternal brother, is considered closer than the paternal brother. Why is its own discussion? Your son or your daughter, your wife, your friend who is closest to you. Interesting that the hierarchy presents wife below, friend who is closest to you. Bowling existed even in those days, apparently. Your bowling friend. We're going to come back to that hierarchy, the last point in the hierarchy about the friend. But the point is that it's a step of that hasn't happened before. Until now, the motivation for him to turn on God has been, subtle is the wrong word, but it hasn't had an agent. Sata never spoke to him. It was just assumed. When he no longer has anything to get from God, he's going to turn on God. That was the assumption. It didn't work. And so now we ramp it up by having his wife say to him, it's time to give up. In case maybe the reason Job is so perfect with God is simply because he lacks the imagination. Now his wife is going to tell him, turn on God. And so she echoes the words of God and the words of Satan. That Mikra notes this. She echoes God by talking about Tumatecha, how you're a Tum. And she echoes Satan using the magic word Barech, which the Satan has used to God, saying, Yivarcheka, he is going to blaspheme against you. Take a look at source number two, a second piece in Da'at Mikra on this. In his commentary to these verses, Amos Chacham writes, Kaviyachol, as it were, Medabera Satan mitoch grona shel eshet Iyov. It's as though the Satan is speaking through her throat. Kilo amar le Iyov, as if he's saying to Iyov, La'achar shenichshalti b'pa'amim ha'kodmo kishabati alecha ba'akifin. He says, you know, I came at you in a roundabout way the last two times. Anusa niyata, lomar lecha b'ferushat ritzoni. I am now compelled to tell you what I want explicitly. Azov tumatcha, abandon your complete state, ubarechet elokim, and bless, so to speak, God. Nimtza shedivrei eshet Iyov ha'nisayon shlishi le'Iyov. This is the third test. That's the idea that Mikra sees here, and I think it resonates with what we're seeing here in the text. She exists in this book as the third test. But she doesn't succeed. A little bit, maybe. A little bit, maybe. Because of this thing about his mouth, he didn't sin with. We're going to come back to that. But he certainly has not been pushed over the edge. Now, for those who are looking for more about Job's wife, like I said, there's nothing in the book. But if you're really interested, there is a Greek work which exists in Hebrew versions, exists in English versions. I gave you a link in source number 3 to an article that talks about it. There is a work which I mentioned at the beginning of the year called Tzava'at Iyov, The Ethical Will of Job. Again, it's not ours, so to speak. It's not from Tanakh. It's the equivalent today of fan fiction, where someone writes about the characters in something and just sort of makes up their own stories about them. So it's Greek fan fiction about the Book of Job. But apparently she has quite the role there in it. You can find it in the Septuagint, interestingly, as well. So take a look there, and you can develop the character. Let's look at these verses carefully now. In sentence 8, we find Job with his piece of pottery scraping himself. Malbim understands that that's meant to build up the image of suffering. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 4, he comments on the juxtaposition of scraping himself with the pottery and sitting in the ashes. He does not take the ashes to be a sign of mourning, which I mentioned last week you could do. He takes it differently. He quotes a midrash which I could not find in the original. He had dry boils on his upper half of his body and needed the pottery to scratch that. But his lower half of the body, he had moist boils. He needed to sit in the ashes to draw out the moisture. And the image is that half of him has one thing, half of him is the other, and the treatment for one is harmful for the other. That's the type of misery that he's in as the scene opens. And then his wife baits him and says, come on, Job, give it up already. Now, Barech is most simply translated as blaspheme, to curse, right, as we've said. Anyone have a translation that actually takes it as bless? Malvin does. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 5. Va'amra lo ishto lahaknito. His wife said to him to bait him, Hinei, The first time round, you blessed God, and literally blessed in a positive way. You blessed God for the harm. You demonstrated that you're complete with him. Well, guess what happened? Right? You blessed him and he hit you again, but he hit you worse. You know, if you bless him again, he's going to hit you again until you're gone. You know, his blessing God only brings suffering, she says to him. What Malbim has accomplished with this, aside from restoring the literal meaning of the word barech, is that he's also introduced a little bit of cause and effect that makes sense. Because I didn't understand why she thought blaspheming God would lead to his death. But if her statement is, you know, every time you bless him, you get hurt worse, do it again and you may be gone, I can understand that as a sarcastic comment to him. Possibly. It's an interesting read for sure. So he responds, and he says to her, will you speak like one of the Nivalot, one of the repellent people? But he still hasn't sinned with his lips. So two ways you can take this. One way to take it is that the emphasis is on still. The other way is that the emphasis is on lips. Meaning, b'chol zos, with all of this, he still hasn't sinned with his lips. But as Ibn Ezra says, watch what's coming next, because he is going to sin with his lips soon. That's Ibn Ezra's take. However, the Talmud takes it the way that we did here. If you take a look at source number 7, b'chol zos lo chata iyov bisfasav, Job still did not sin verbally with his lips. Amar Rava bisfasav lo chata, b'libo chata. With his lips he didn't, but he was already giving up. Even if his words didn't state it explicitly. And the truth of the matter is, you can see it within his words. Take a look, please, at the distinctions that are subtle, but they're there, between what he says here in verse 10 and what he said at the end of the first chapter about God's actions. Can you tell me what there is that is positive in his reaction to the first time that's gone from his reaction to the second time? No, within his words. Right, he hasn't blessed, using the blessing in the positive, and... Yeah?
Well, when he says, I'm really upset to you, but he says, whatever I get is my life, it doesn't matter. I don't have any reason to expect anything. Here he's distinguishing between good and evil.
Right, what he did before... In the end of chapter 1, was to say, it's all fair. Whatever I have, God gave me. God is now going to take it away. Okay, he's going to take it away. It's up to him. Here, he said, it's evil. Right? He used the word ra. Whether I want to read ra as bad, evil, I'm not particularly interested in the degree. Once you say that something God did is bad, you've made a very important theological step. What Job has done here, yes, I will accept whatever God does, whether he does something good or whether he does something really mean, God. Right? That's what he's saying. He's saying what you've done is bad. That's not something he did before. Take a look, please, at Malbim, who notes it in source number 8. He tries to explain what Job is saying. Shu Chashav, Job thought, Job thought that the good that is found in our world is mixed with a lot of bad. And therefore he thought that it can't be that God is just going to give you good. If you want the good, you have to take the bad as well. But that implies that whatever God does is going to have bad in it. Kimo, he gives you an example. He says, if a person wants to drink a lot of wine, eat a lot of honey, because he says, I like the way it tastes. He can't complain about the hangover. Right? You knew it was going to happen. Or if the honey harms his stomach. So Dat Mikra says in source number 9, Shebidvarav Rishonim Diber Yov Al Hanagat Hashem Shekach Ra'uy Lo Lehiot Noten Velokeach Kirtzono. In his first words, Job said, it's appropriate for God to do as he wishes, giving and taking. Vadam Chayav Levarchot Tamid, and a person just has to bless him. Ve'ilu Bidvarav Eileh Diber Yov Al Hanagat Ha'adam. Here, Job doesn't talk about what God has a right to do. He talks about what the human being does. Shia nichna le'lokim v'kabel imenu et hakol, that the human being has to be humble and just accept everything. Avalo amar shamnam kein roi le'lokim l'nog. He didn't say this is good for God to do. You follow? Job shifted the focus. The first time round, the focus was on what God does. The second time round, the focus is on how man responds. And the first time round, it's whatever God does is appropriate because he's God. And the second time round, it's man is just going to have to deal with it because this is his lot in life. So there may not be an explicit declaration against God, but there's a judgment of what God does is wrong. Wrong, harmful, bad, however you want to read it. Kitty and Dan.
Maybe there's a judgment in himself that he's unsure in his head whether he's done something wrong.
Where do you see that?
Though he realizes he feels that he has not done anything wrong, but then maybe in his head, maybe I have, and I don't even realize it. I mean, that's human nature.
But where do you see that in him? Like, what words of his lead that?
He says, and he's accepting it up to a point.
Mm-hmm.
He's not rejecting God, and he's not, he's not blaspheming God. But I feel in the last thing, he's unsure what he's doing.
That's what people begin to say. It's like the corporal God that he did for his children. In his mind, he wasn't sure if they had done something.
So, right, my problem is just then he shouldn't be labeling it Ra. If it was really, as Kitty suggests, and as Susan is supporting from the Karbanot, that he feels maybe I did something wrong, then he wouldn't call it Ra. Calling it Ra is a judgment, this is bad. I don't think you do that unless you actually feel something's happening that is undeserved, that is bad. Diana, and then Shayna, and then I'm going to go further.
I feel like we can't really have it both ways. I think the Malbim is being really, really hard on Hiob. First response was almost the perfect response that it is superhuman. Second response, he's starting to talk a little bit more like a human being, and we're critiquing him for it. And after all, the quote that you brought a couple of weeks ago from the Torah, Hashem Borei Ra, I mean, it's in the Torah, so for him to acknowledge there's bad and evil in the world, is, I don't think it's sinful.
Right. I think what's stimulating Malbim in this regard, Diana points out that, he sounds pretty good. As we would normally evaluate people's responses to utter and complete catastrophe, this doesn't sound like a bad response. But I think what Malbim is doing is trying to explain the Pasuk. And he's stuck on the fact that the Pasuk added in with his lips. Why do I have that qualifier here? Text is so careful. Why do we have that added in here where I didn't see it before? And that's what's making him assume that Job has in fact gotten pushed a little further. I think that's what's... I hear you, but I think that's what's driving him. Shayna, and then I'm going to go... Okay, great. Okay. So let's see what happens now, because Job's not done, and the Satan isn't done either, as we'll see. We're now going to read the last three sentences in chapter 2. Vayishmeu shloshet re'ei iyo veit kol hara'ah hazot haba'a alav. Sentence 11 there. The three friends of Eov, we're going to call them friends just because I don't have a better word. Right? Interlocutors is not a friendly word. There are three people who come to talk to Job. They believe that they're actually doing him a favor. So I'm willing to call them friends. The word in the Hebrew, re'ah, is a loose enough word. You kind of wonder, actually, about whether re'ah and ra are intended to be associated here. Friends and fiends in English. But in any case, these three people hear about all the terrible things, haba'a Allah, that have happened to Job. Vayavalu ish mimakama, when each one comes from his place. So each one arrived independently. Eliphaz ha-Temani. Eliphaz of Teman. We're going to come back to the names and their places soon. U-Bildad ha-Shuchi. Bildad of Shuach, apparently. V'tzofar ha-Na'amati. Tzofar from a place called Na'ama. V'yivo'adu yachdav. And they met together. So they all join up. Lavo lanud lo ulanachamo. To come shake their heads for him and comfort him. Is that how Lanudlo is shake their heads in yours?
Mourn.
Oh yeah, mourn in the art scroll. Bemoan. Okay. We're gonna come back to the word Lanud. We have to see what that means. From afar, they pick up their eyes, they see him, but they don't recognize him. They raise their voices. They cry. Each one tears his clothing. They throw dirt on their heads heavenward, over their heads. And they sit with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights. No one speaks. Because they saw that the pain was so great. Okay, questions from these three psukim.
This then stayed with him 7 days and seven nights. Was that sort of like Shiva?
Is there an association with Shiva? Good question. Yes,
ma'am. If it is Shiva, then how did Hindu so fast?
Right. If this really was Shiva, like for his kids, they're actually late because we've had some time pass. So, good question. What is this 7 day period meant to be? Shana and then Susan.
Why did the three of them come together to go together to him? Why did they come to different places together?
Yeah. What's with they? Are they together or are they not together? I'm not clear on that. Susan.
They didn't throw the afar on themselves. They actually did on a rush. About Lamala meaning to the heavens. So,
right. Are
they sending a message to God?
Good question. Right. Is this an act of grief about themselves? The truth is we use the word Hashamayim sometimes to just mean up. But you're right, using a word in a book that pays a lot of attention to language, you know, you sort of wonder, is this a prayer to God? An expression of anger? What exactly is that about? Rebecca?
I'm wondering whether Eel sitting there and three people approaching him or sees we're supposed to think of Abraham.
Abraham visited by three strangers. Except these aren't strangers.
Role, but they also have a role in terms of moving the story along and bringing out new ideas.
Right. Okay. Yeah, Joyce.
Close to what Susan said, the addition of each one from his own place seems to have some sense.
Yeah. Right. Having them together, having them apart, this is very odd. Ralph?
They have no obligation to Korea, and they have no obligation. Use dust because right. They're not.
Right. For a ritual perspective, they're not mourners, correct? Okay, so let's see what we can do with all of this. Yeah. Sorry?
I'm wondering what influence these three strangers have on him if he had to curse the day, if they said that a word to him.
Ah, so we aren't there yet. You're right. You're in chapter 3. How does this lead to his response? How does their silence? The next sentence is actually the beginning of chapter 3. I know it can fool you the way it's printed in the editions of Tanakh. But how will Job react to their silence? Is their silence a good thing? Is their silence a bad thing? Is it just a human reaction? What exactly is that?
They're not supposed to react until he speaks.
Maybe.
That's the custom.
That is a custom, correct. Yes?
In my translation, and I find it kind of disturbing, it says that Moshe wrote Eel.
Yeah.
And obviously, this is not the only person who has said that, I'm sure. Well, I mean, it says something like, is that a
So, right. So here, I'm not going to go back over it because we did spend a lot of time on authorship the first couple of weeks. Now, not everyone was here the first couple of weeks. But God willing, as was requested earlier, I will resend the link to be able to download the past classes so everyone will be able to get access to it, because the stuff we said then really does have an impact on understanding things as we go forward, particularly in a case like this, like you're raising here. So, yes, it's a good question. I just want to refer back. So first of all, names and places and roles for these three visitors. excuse me. Dat Mikra makes an interesting point. They're listed in a particular order. Eliphaz, and then Bildad, and then Sofar. That order will follow through when they do speak throughout the book. During these cycles of speeches I gave you on the first sheet that we had way back when, and I showed you, it's Eliphaz, then Bildad, then Sofar. Eliphaz, then Bildad, then Sofar. They stay in that order. And not only that, they have a consistent pattern. Eliphaz says, I have a vision. He always speaks of visions. And Bildad will speak of having a tradition from elders. And so far, we'll speak of having chokhmah, of having wisdom. And these are themes within the speeches of each of them. And the commentators, especially Ralbag, but not just Ralbag, tend to see in their presentations statements of philosophy. What emerges from this, Rambam, Maimonides especially, and Ralbag, is that these three people are meant to play roles in a dialogue with Job, with Eov. They each represent certain ideas that he is going to have to deal with, and the book is going to have to deal with. The idea then of them coming from afar and joining together suggests almost a Greek-style debate, in which the people are going to come from afar with their ideas, and they're all going to meet together, and then they're going to have a big public forum in which they're going to put out their ideas and debate them with each other, and the crowd's going to vote on whether they like them or not. It seems like they are meant to be, just like Job's wife, they're meant to be roles within the story. And they represent people from everywhere. So Eliphaz from Teman, and Bildad from Shuach, and Sofar from Naamah, means you have people like them that they are coming from different parts of the world, other people with those ideas. These are representatives of communities. That's the idea that I would put forth here. In terms of the names that are involved, Eliphaz is the only name that actually appears somewhere in Tanakh besides here. Sorry? Yes.
The firstborn of, I think this is right,
Asa. That's right, I'm the father of?
Amalek.
You got it.
And the husband of
Timnah. Very good. Full credit. This is true. The problem is that if I were to take this Eliphaz as a reference to that Eliphaz, then what about Bildad? And what about Sofar? Why are we just throwing in random wicked person with very bad family into a story about Job who may not even be Jewish? So it's very hard to work with that. One note, though, Dat Mikra does make, the word Eliphaz can be broken down into two parts. Eli, my God, Paz, which doesn't just mean gold, it also means strong. Vayafozu Zeroei Yadav. In the bracha that Yaakov gives to his children. So the idea is then, my God is strong, which would fit his attempts to defend God in this book. The problem still is, what do I do with their other names? Bildad, in the Olam HaTanach edition of Yov, they take it possibly as a Babylonian name, meaning beloved or firstborn son of Adad. I wondered, for those who were with us for Daniel 2 years ago, you recall that the name Belshazzar, beginning with Baal, was because there was a Babylonian god, Baal. So I wondered if you could make that association, but frankly, if Olam HaTanach didn't do so, I think not, because they would have for sure done that. So I don't know. So far, again, nothing really could do with it. Sounds like Tzipor. Okay, good. I don't really know what to do with these names. The places also do not admit easy identification. Taman being particularly difficult, because again, as we saw when we talked about the Sabaeans potentially coming from Taman to attack, that's far south. That's passed all through Saudi Arabia. I mean, it came from far away, but really? Maybe. So, these three people join in. Job, later in the book, in Perek Yetet, chapter 19, is going to talk about how all his friends have abandoned him. Whether he means these people, and they've abandoned him because they don't agree with him, or whether he means he had loads more who didn't show up. He's got three people coming to grieve when he's had so many different associates, is, you know, unclear. You could take either one. But these three become very clearly, as we'll see in his response to them, and the rest of the book, tools of the Satan, providing another test for him to see what he's going to do. Now, I mentioned Lanud Rosh. So on your sheet, I gave you in source number 10 references. We're not going to look them up now. I just wanted to show you this phrase is used elsewhere in Tanakh to indicate an act of grieving, an act of saying, what a shame, to somebody. And you think about it, it's a gesture, it's a natural gesture. You shake your head like, oi, you know, that's what this is, Lanud Rosh. The to shake, literally Lanud is to shake. Here's an odd note. I'm going to throw in something that really doesn't fit here, but frankly I didn't notice it when I was preparing the introduction. And so I'm putting it in here because here's where the comment is actually made. Take a look on the second side of your sheet at source number 11. I really don't know what to do with it. In my favor, nobody else knows what to do with it either. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, trying to figure out what all these place names are, writes the following. Mimishpacha Teman ben Eliphaz ben Esav, from the family of Teman, son of Eliphaz, son of Esav. So he mentions this idea. Vakarob Eli, it appears accurate to me, most accurate, ki hu sefer miturgam, that Job was not originally written in Hebrew. That it was originally written in some other language. Al kein hu kasha b'feirush, and therefore it's really hard to translate it, to explain it. Kederach kol sefer miturgam, like every translated book, because you don't know what the original intent was. That is a wild statement. It's not, like, it's not religiously difficult. Avraham Ibn Ezra is very firm. My problem is not with that. There's nothing wrong with the idea that the original language of this book was, let's say, Ugaritic, or some ancient version, forerunner of Arabic, and that at some point it's translated into Hebrew, and the Anshei Gedolei HaSagadola canonize it. Doesn't bother me from a religious perspective. I just want to know where he got this idea from. Because no one else talks about this. Spinoza quotes him and is thrilled, interestingly, in his Tractatus Theologio Politicus, twice, chapter 7 and chapter 10. He quotes Ibn Ezra saying this because he finds it interesting in his discussion of how religious texts evolved. And he also says, I wish that Ibn Ezra had substantiated it, because this is the sort of thing I like. That's what he writes in chapter 10. But it's just this wild comment that, if nowhere, it really belonged in the introduction to Eov, but I didn't know about it at the time. I only hit it now. Okay. Going back to what's happening, though, on the scene here, because we only have a couple of minutes left. His friends don't recognize him. That mikra takes it literally, that the boils are actually disfiguring on his skin. But I wonder if this isn't like in Sefer Rut, in the book of Ruth, right? Where they say, Hazo Naomi, could this be Naomi when she comes back impoverished and alone and starving and all? You know, I wonder if that isn't what's going on here. You were going to say?
I'm just wondering if they're just playing on the letters, like Aleph and then Tuf, like the first letter, last letter, and then Bet is the second letter, and the Shin is the second last letter. Sort of like people are coming from all over and there's worldliness.
Interesting, but it didn't work for it so far.
Right.
Oh, that would have been good.
Two middle letters, as if they're kind of...
Right, the Atbash game. You have the first and last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Eliphaz starts with an Aleph. Temani would start with a Tav. And then the second letter is further in. The Bet for Bildad and the Shin, the next last letter of the alphabet for Shuchi. It would be good if it continued. But,
the last letter in English.
Sorry?
Same words in English.
Yes. Well, Z works in Canadian. Z works in English. The, but, oh, stop it. The, if you take a look at source number 12, the 7 days, so it was noted, this sounds like Shiva. In fact, Shiva appears early on in the Torah. Yaakov, when he passes away, Joseph and his brothers sit Evel Shivat Yamim. They mourn for 7 days. Now, it was pointed out, they're late if they're mourning for 7 days. Nonetheless, I don't think the point is to say that they actually had an obligation to grieve properly, as much as them saying, Imo Anochi Betzara, we are with him in his suffering, and we're going to perform the acts that one performs when grieving, because they're grieving for him. For their friend who they just saw completely devastated. To me, that's what they're doing, and it emphasizes the completeness of it by saying 7 days and seven nights. It's meant to say this is complete. But they are silent. They do not actually have words that they can offer. Silence would appear to be shock. I brought you here in source number 13. In the interest of time, I'm not going to read it aloud, but you see it there. The Talmud actually traces the traditional Jewish practice that when one goes into a house of mourning, one does not speak until spoken to by the people in mourning. The Talmud says, yeah, that's because of this. Because they don't speak until Job speaks to them. The problem with it is that it really seems like a negative here. In the book, it sounds like it gets Job angry because he doesn't curse the day he was born until after they've shown up and are silent. He didn't do it in response to his wife. And this is the only other stimulus that's taken place. So it sounds like he's not so happy about the silence. What is clear, though, is that they perform the deeds of mourning, but they don't have anything to offer beyond that. They have nothing to offer in terms of consolation. And that in and of itself, I think, is further seduction towards blasphemy. This is the last step for him. And now, even his closest friends, and we assume they're his closest, we don't know that, but the three who actually picked up and came to see him have nothing whatsoever to say to make him feel better. And at that point, it does seem he hits bottom. So in a brief summary of what we've seen in this chapter, and next week we'll start, God willing, with chapter 3, Satan began the chapter by sending a further blow to Job, claiming that people value their own existences more than those of others, even their own kids. And once his own existence is lost, then he will rebel. Job doesn't rebel. His wife is inserted here as a further push. Even his wife says he should give up. However we understand what she said, however we understand why she said it, it's what she said. And still he doesn't give up. And then his friends come and they're helpless to console him. And then he's really going to hit bottom. Now, on the one hand, I feel like it's a terrible way to end. On the other hand, I feel like it's exactly the way to end today. We end today as we began. But I would ask, please, if you could take a few minutes to read chapter 3. It's a short chapter. I think it will help a lot in terms of understanding it when we approach it next week. As I said in the beginning of the course, I'm intending to speed up for the middle to cover sections as opposed to word by word. And this is the point where we start to do that. So the more we can actually look at it in advance, the better off we'll be. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.